Oh, yes. No, I'm quite interested in this.
I'm trying to shut but there have been turning points in that throughout my life. The spray drying discovery was completely changed my life around. It enabled me, geez, at one time, as a young man, I was pulling $50,000 and $100,000 a year selling those spray dryers. And that made me very independent, and that's important.
How did that develop? How did you get into that in the first place? And what was the key
that
there?
That was this. it was for the department. I don't think that should go in the record, how it came, because it was the work was highly secret. It was carried out for the Ministry of Defense. But after that, they told me, all right, don't mention our name ever, but what you have developed, you can patent. There I was wise enough not to patent. I was consulting for Bourne Engineering and but I never patented this, but the milk industry knew about me, and they were not about to tell them that the milk was spray dried or anything like that. Industry, particularly in Canada, and even this states, it's a closed shop, you see. But that was one turning point due to this absolutely unexpected project that I was asked to carry out. Another turning point was one day. That was during the early 50s. A friend of mine who had obtained a PhD was a chemist at the same time. We had lunch together at a faculty club.
That cigarette is backwards, by the way.
Thank you. Would you like one?
No, I'm fine.
You're not mine much more?
No, not at all.
We were having lunch at a faculty club. He says, Bill, I have a terrible problem. I've been asked, I'm working for the Pulp and Paper Research Institute, he says, I'm a research associate there, and they asked me to fluidize bark and extra find what kind of organic chemicals you can get from the treatment of bark at high temperature. I said, you're nuts, you cannot fluidize bark. Bark is full of little fibers and all that. But he says, I think I know how to do it. And I'll come back to the lab with you this afternoon, and we'll have. Do you have for safety reasons? Do you have in your lab a bucket full of sand? He says every lab has a bucket full of sand. I said, okay, put sand in your reactor. And we fluidized your goddamn bark. And and it was going. We were evolving a lot of crap, but that was his business. He wanted to. At this moment, about 4 o'clock, in walks a tall, handsome man. Hello, gentlemen, what are you doing? And Alan got up on his feet immediately, almost saluted. And he says, Dr. Fismayer, I want you to meet a good friend of mine. He's giving me a hand. His name is Bill Gova. He's attached to the Department of Chemical Engineering. Oh, he says, hello, Bill. He says, my name is Fizz. That was his nickname. And he says, you know, the problems of pulp and paper industry? I said, no. What's the problem? We're shortage of sulfur. And it was true. You're too young to remember those days. But in Canada, no sulfur, no pulp and paper. And is there any way of recovering sulfur from the spent liquors lessive? I said, no, but I could take a crack at it. So anyway, we talked to friendly and said, let's have a drink. We had a drink. Let's have dinner. We had dinner. Come back to my house. I went back to his office. He was a heavy drinker, and I don't mind having a drink. At 12 o'clock, I walked out. I had a job, and a damn good one, in the Pulp and Paper Research Institute, which is next door. It was ideal, at a good salary. This time I accepted a salary, no BS. And I've been, 2 years later, I became head of his chemical engineering division, which was small, mind you. There were never more than 20 of them. And we worked like hell, and we recovered the sulfur. But by that time, sulfur was plentiful. So my hazel of death initially disappeared. But in the meantime, I had developed a new technique of treating waste pulp liquors called AST, atomized suspension technique, which we patented. That one we patented. And that was a huge success. That was simply contacting a spray, spray drying, mm-hmm. That's it. I always, capitalize on my little baggage. And that was properly taken up by the industry. And I was ahead of his chemical engineering division until 1962, at which time, as I told you before, I latched on to the Noranda people, because I visualized that I was developing a lot of interesting processes. Few of them applied to the pulp and paper, and Fesmeyer was on the fire, and I knew this indirectly, and he couldn't continue to support my work, and by that time I got $1 million. It was a good sum in those days. So we kissed goodbye, and shortly after I left, strangely enough, he had made some enemies. He drank too much, and he had built this huge lab. It's amazing. That is on St. John Road. It's within, you could see it if you had your room facing there. And he built that lab in 1956, but I stayed downtown. It was a beautiful lab, and that's to his credit. Then he was replaced by another friend of mine, incidentally. But by that time, I felt that Noranda offered a better future. It was a big company, and we dickered a heck of a lot because they didn't want me to go on with my McGill. I said, I'd never leave McGill, I'd never leave Dickett or leave it. So they left it. But they came back a few months later. In the meantime, I got a partner. They wanted to get in the pulp and paper industry all of a sudden. Using my knowledge of the industry. So I tried, for a brief period, I crossed the ocean 2-3 times a month, because mistakenly I thought the British would be a good partners, but they were afraid to invest in Canada. So finally, in desperation, I said, to hell with the British, let's go with the Americans, which I did, and I made a few phone calls. Meat Corporation accepted, and they had the guts to build, in those days, 1,000 ton a day craft mill in Prince George, which is in operation to this day. 1,000 tons a day now is not exactly small potatoes, but it's not the biggest in the world. But at the time it was. So they're still partnered with Mead, and Mead is still using my AST, so sometimes I get a call and I whip over and correct things, and that's, I had a lot of fun in my life, you know. I could have made a lot of money if I had patented, and even now I could have developed lately some processes which I carefully didn't patent. and well, to complete, so that was the third turning point. The second turning point was the appearance of Fischmeyer on the scene, completely unexpected. That, my friend, is a turning point. And very quickly, he was a decisive. This is, that guy is we were very similar, energetic, and lots of pep. Mm-hmm. Now all you see is a shell, you see, but in those days, my dear fellow, he gave me what I needed, a freedom and the funds and so on. No, rather didn't. They tried me to keep me on a tight leash, but I felt I was getting older, and it was 50 when I made this change. I said, Bill, let's smarten up, let's stay put. It turned out to be a good company. I made a good salary. When I was 65, 1 month I was all ready, and I formed a company, all ready to move. And I got a call from the chairman, who was president, Al Powers, a very good friend. He says, Bill, we can't find a replacement for you. Will you work for us another 5 years? No, he said 3 years. No way, 3 years. At 68, I'll be completely out of touch. 5 years. And I said, what's the incentive? $10,000 more a year. I said, that does it. So I stayed with that with them. And then when I left them, my small company was in operation, and then I got a big contract on with Hydro-Québec, because I'd sold my patent for that. I got the dollar for all my patents on plasmas, and I sold them personally for $950,000. I wanted $1 million, and I would have accepted $50,000. But the guy says, Bill, you're a heart. I offer you $900,000. The damn fool. And we set up for $950,000. But then I was hired to promote the development of plasma for Hydro-Québec. But they didn't want to let me, to give me a free hand the way I wanted to do it. I was working for a guy there who was really a hard nut. And finally, but I had my PhD students, but this time with in the Hydro-Québec lab, which is a wonderful lab, except I had...
That's here in Montreal.
That's in the suburbs. That's 50 miles, not quite, from my home. So there I was every morning, leaving in a horrendous traffic, coming back at night. Then I killed myself. But then finally, at the end of 1989, sorry, I got fed up and I resigned. And since then, I am I'm semi-retired, but very active for McGill. I'm on the board of governors. I'm on the investment committee, which I love. The pension funds, which I love less, certain promotional groups and so on, various committees, and still on the board of governors, and that's it. That's the story of my life.
What changes have you seen in McGill from the time you first arrived? How would you characterize McGill when you arrived, and how would you characterize it today?
It is overburdened by administration. The desire of the principal to please everybody, and so as a result, it's very slow in making decisions. Reluctance to cut down on the... McGill is in a hell of a financial situation. Our debt is now about $70 million accumulated over the... You see, McGill gets most of its funds from Quebec, which gets its funds from the federal, and Quebec insists on allocating these federal funds and do the to the various universities, and they have been very tough with, to be honest with you, very tough with McGill. It is now being being corrected, so I think this year for the first time we'll close our budget after an awful lot of soul searching, and that caused David Johnston to engage in a monumental program of soul searching. Priorities, you should see the priorities, it's ridiculous how they go into unbelievable details and details and so on, and it's not an exactly dynamic university, but they're fortunate, they have the big deal, they have a high rating. I don't know if you're aware of the Gorman assessment. Gorman is a guy who has taken upon himself to rate universities in throughout the world, the Western world, and we come very high in chemical engineering. We're number two or number three. I forget, we have Stanford, I believe, is number one. We're ahead of MIT, actually. So we're very high, rated very high. But it's not very efficient. David, he's so anxious to please everybody, God damn it. And, how many times when I raise my hand at board meetings, yes, he says, Bill, and what have you got to say again? Yes. So I really have to use my judgment after all.
Let me go back again to your early days at McGill. You ran into Winkler through this RDX
program.
That's
right. Because we didn't have, at the time when I started this working in 41, I was the only guy teaching any chemical engineering at McGill, and I wanted to, and then I was forced by the government to work on RDX. And for Winkler, it was he turned out to be a close friend of mine. And then I got a master in master of chemical engineering. It was just a paper thesis, so, but I got a master's degree in. And then I wanted to get a PhD in chemical engineering, but I couldn't. It was not allowed by the Department of Chemistry. A one-man department could not have a graduate program at the doctorate's level. So I turned around the difficulty, and my own degree, my PhD, is not in chemical engineering. It's in physical chemistry. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yes, I did notice that. Yeah, that's what I was getting to. I wanted to ask you about that.
And then by that time, Phillips came back from London. He had a very important job in London. He was the coordinator of sulfuric acid production for the Allies. That's a tremendous job. And he came back. He was also very energetic, tremendous. And then the two of us, we said, we've got to have a productive program. So we insisted and insisted, and finally at first all my students were master's students. They had to be, there was no PhD. But I think around the middle 50s,
I think 54 I read some.
54 is my first PhD?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it, that's fair.
Could you tell me some more about Winkler? What kind of a person was he to work for?
Well, I should tell you that as an example of the nature of the guy, I was profoundly fed up with my work on RDX. And to the point that when I got my master's degree in 42, and Winkler assigned me, I had to, there's no turning around. I hated it. And then I started to drink and fool around, and sometimes it went weeks before I even reported to my lab. He didn't say anything. But he gave me the silent treatment, and I felt worse and worse and worse. So one day, I came out to see him. Doc, can I show you some curves that I obtained? He said, did you do some experimental work? And I said, oh boy. But that went right through my heart. And I couldn't make head or tail of that goddamn curve. And he was an analyst. He said, that's an excellent piece of work. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Look at the scatter. Forget about the goddamn scatter. He says, look at this curve. He says, that's now you have to refine the data. But I'm very pleased with this. Keep it up. And that was it. From here on, I started working like a dog. And then I asked him permission. I said, for God's sake, I go out on the RDX, but let me do something else. Well, he says, I'm very interested in electrochemical deposition of copper, strangely enough. And that played a role with Nareda eventually. And he says, I'd like you to, on the QT, start a project on the effect of addition agents on the properties of the metallic deposit that you get. And this was my first 10 papers were on that.
Now, there was an industrial relationship there, too, wasn't there? I mean, was he consulting with companies?
Yes, he was consulting for Inco.
Okay.
And I got a scholarship from Inco in addition to this IDX work. And he insisted. Inco was a strange company. I could never get them interested in my work. So Winkler, I was there in his office, he got mad when they called the vice principal. I'm coming to see you next week with my student, Bill Gover. And he said, we want to show you our results, which are very interesting. And interesting. And reluctantly, the guy accepted us. And he kept us there, he got interested. And from then on, we got his attention. Because they were also depositing copper, but not at the same level as Canadian copper refineries. It were our big refineries that belonged to Miranda. So I went to see Canadian copper refineries. All my life I was mixed up with Miranda, with Inco, and so on. It's fun.
So you did this electrochemical work on the side while you were doing the RDX work.
Yes, that's exactly it.
That must, well, you said you had the energy. It must have required a lot of time.
Yeah, 12 hours a day and weekends and things like that. But when I was interested, then it was interesting work. We were breaking ground, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One for the. And I'm not bragging, you know, actually. I'm telling you, I'm answering your questions.
No, that's fine. Well, you had a paper, let's see, you said the first 10 papers were mostly electrochemical with Winkler.
Yeah.
But then you did have, by 1955, you had a paper on spray drying.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So you were moving in that area already.
That's right,
too.
Yeah. By then, I, well, to be honest with you, I was designing those, it's rather amusing. All the spray dryers in existence at the time which I had designed were either identically the same size as the ones that I had developed for Frank W. Hoyer on blood plasma drying, or a multiple thereof, doubling everything, but not altering the relationship of the important parameters. In other words, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I was doing something right, you see. And then I said, this has got to stop. And this is when I started this whole series of papers on spray drying, but much further, this is where I started to work on particles, the motion of particles. Yes. And I had endless papers on that, which was a fascinating field. And finally we knew what we were doing.
Well, I know, I recall one paper that you had where you used, you did some radioactive tracer work to try and trace the...
With lead turbine, yes.
To try and follow the particles.
That's right, yes. That was a clever piece of work. And actually, Len Turbin, who was a guy who did that particular work with me, was at that New York party. I shook hands with him, and I found, shaking his hand, that he still had the scars. That guy, he was so anxious to get a hot particle, we had it irradiated at Chalk River, and we got this in what we call a castle, all lead. And he was so anxious to get the goddamn particle out of the castle into this enormous wind tunnel, he had, did it with his hands. A foolish thing to do, but I said, Len, what are you doing, for Christ's sake? These particles are, to this day, he has the scars, but he's being followed and there is no danger at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not proud of that at all, because but I never had any accident, but it was a very, very effective way of measuring the velocity of particles under all kinds of conditions, all kinds of shapes, all kinds of acceleration, deceleration, and so on. And the work went on with fellows like the oscillation of, we certainly knew our particle dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Stuart Churchill was very interested in this. And he became a very good friend. And then the oscillatory motion and so on, yeah.